By a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Jason Croft is at the controls. As Jay Pierce mentioned just before the news, tomorrow morning we will be carrying live coverage of hearings of the Senate Armed Services Committee, provided to us by National Public Radio. We are expecting that they're going to address the issue of prisoner abuse in the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq and the chain of command and ultimately who was responsible for setting those rules. There will be a panel of high-ranking military officers scheduled to testify. General John Abizaid, the commander of the U.S. Central Command, General Ricardo Sanchez, commander of the multinational force in Iraq, and General Jeffrey Miller. He's the deputy commander for detainee operations for the multinational force in Iraq. We're expecting that this will begin at 7:30 our time and will take most of the morning, and that means it will preempt part of Morning Edition and also probably most or all of Focus 580 for tomorrow, and then we'll be back on our regular schedule then on Thursday. And we will reschedule the programs that we were going to do tomorrow, so you'll have an opportunity to hear them on another day. So again, this is live coverage from National Public Radio, hearings of the Senate Armed Services Committee, tomorrow morning beginning at 7:30 our time. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about a movement within the field of architecture to try to bring those kind of design services to a larger kind of group. Because one of the things that we know is that only a tiny percent, and one of the figures that has been cited, in fact, is 2%, just 2% of new home buyers ever work directly with an architect to design the space in which they will live. For most people, this is a luxury that they simply cannot afford. However, as I say, there is this growing movement within the design field to serve a broader population, particularly people who are on the lower end of the income spectrum. And this morning, we'll be talking with Brian Bell. He is founder of Design Corps, which is a nonprofit agency that provides architecture to those traditionally underserved by the profession. He is also the editor of a collection of articles or essays dealing with this movement within architecture. His book is titled Good Deeds, Good Design, Community Service Through Architecture. It's published by the Princeton Architectural Press, and if you're interested, I'm sure that you could find it at a bookstore near you, or you can go to their website, which is www.papress.com, and get information on the book. As we talk, questions are welcome. That's always the case. And if you want to call in here, the number, if you're in Champaign-Urbana, is 333-9455. We do also have the toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Bell, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. I read an article about you. This appeared in the New Orleans paper, the Times-Picayune, talking a little bit about your background and how you got into this. And I thought I might ask you about to talk a little bit about that in the beginning. And it, according to this article, you had, it in quotes, a cushy job as an architect with a Manhattan firm. Now, I'm not exactly sure what exactly that means, but you were working in the big city when you decided to move away from that and do something very different, I'm sure, right, working for a very different kind of clientele.
Right.
How did you end up making that move?
Well, it's interesting. When I went into architecture, I had no idea that I was really entering a sort of luxury service. And it wasn't until I graduated from Yale Architecture School with a master's and went to work in Manhattan, actually got the job I wanted, but pretty quickly realized that this was not that fulfilling to me, and I was pretty frustrated by the very tight group of jobs and really more the social status end of design rather than really what I believe design to be, which is something that can really help people out in their day-to-day lives and also address some of our more important social issues. And so fairly quickly I became disillusioned with that path, which I'm afraid is the pretty typical path for most graduates like myself. And so I just started looking for alternatives. And frankly, I was also feeling pretty redundant in New York. It seems that everybody, my classmates all go to either New York or Chicago or San Francisco, so there's a tremendous concentration of talent there, whereas there are huge areas in the country that don't seem to have anybody who can provide design. So my sort of search led me to rural Pennsylvania, where my younger sister was working with migrant farm workers, and she was telling me about the terrible housing situation they had. And it just sort of struck me that, hey, this was a place that I'd actually be needed, and I could help people with basic shelter and apply the benefits of my very fortunate education and energy to something that seemed to be more have more social benefit than what I was doing. Hmm. So that sort of I call it a very early midlife crisis, basically right out of school, and it's been great. That was 15 years ago, and I have not looked back. It's really been the direction I've wanted to go, but I've learned a lot along the way and continue to learn and find others doing this work.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the first thing that you designed once you started thinking in this way and saw that there was this particular need, the first building that you did.
Sure. Well, fortunately, I was able to visit many migrant camps in Pennsylvania as the first step, and I think one of the best things I learned is that I didn't know anything about migrants. I mean, and I fortunately said to myself, I didn't, because architects have a tendency to think we know everything, and I don't know how we come up with that, but it gets us into a lot of problems and alienates us from people when we think we know more about what they want than they do. So fortunately, I was able to visit migrant camps and talk to a lot of migrants, but also talk to farmers about what they were providing. And I began to realize that there was some real, there were obvious social problems and substandard housing. But I began to identify that some of the types of housing were causing problems. And I'll give you an example. The main type of housing that was being provided was called a bullpen, which was just a big open room with lots of single males in it. Now, these were migrants coming from several different countries, and because of this type of housing, it required a crew leader. Well, if you checked with the Pennsylvania Department of Labor, it was the crew leaders that were generally causing the problems, overcharging for food and not keeping up the quality of the housing. So, in other words, this type of housing caused some problems because it necessitated a crew leader. So what we did was we looked at other types and realized that the smaller unit of housing that could house four or five people that were already friends that maybe came together in a car could live together. And that may seem more expensive, and it is, but we also got grant funding to help pay for the cost. And what I'd say to farmers, I'd say, you know, if I'm living with 100 other guys, I'm not going to go in and clean the bathroom. But if I'm living with four other friends, you know, we'll take turns, and I'll make sure that you take your turn. So that was a kind of sort of simple, common sense thing that I learned that led to a better idea in housing than what was being built currently.
Mm. And it sounds like it would be the kind of thing where people would have a little bit more of a feeling of personal space rather than living in something that would have been like a barracks.
Exactly. Exactly, and there were language problems and fights and in the larger housing, and you know, that's not something the farmer wanted, but he was kind of stuck with that because of that type of housing. The other thing that was happening at the time, this was back in late 1980s, and a lot of families were beginning to travel in the migrant stream because of the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act. So a single guy who was working became a resident, a legal resident, and was able to bring his family along with him. Well, the housing was a disaster for trying to accommodate families. So these smaller units were able to either accommodate some single guys, or if the farmer wanted to, he could hire a family that could move right into the single unit. So that's the kind of, it may seem sort of clear, but I don't think that people that aren't trained in architecture sometimes can identify why these problems are happening. And also, bringing in the extra funding to help with the construction costs made it a cheaper end product for the farmer than the larger housing, in fact. So it was, I like to think of it as a win-win.
So it seemed to function better for the individuals, and as far as the farmers were concerned, they were actually saving money. It was costing them less. But I suppose that was in part because some of the funding was coming from they didn't have to provide all of the funding themselves.
That's right. They put up 50% of the construction funds, and the Pennsylvania Department of Housing put up 50%. Now, Pennsylvania thought it was a great deal because they're used to paying 100%. So all of a sudden, they had a 50% match coming from the private sector. Farmer thought it was great because he's had to pay for the whole thing before. And it was also a benefit to the farmer because I would explain that if he's able to attract his workers back again, then he doesn't have to retrain them. So there was definite economic incentives for the farmer to use this program.
Hmm. What sort of longevity do these buildings have?
Well, the first ones we built was 7 years ago, and I have gone back every year, and they look great. So we're looking at them every year to see how they do. We definitely build them to last. The farmer commits to a 20-year compliance period. He has to maintain them for 20 years. We don't actually just give him the 50% of construction costs. He has to maintain them for 20 years, and then after that, then he does own the building outright. But so we've built them to last for 20 years, and 7 years in, we're doing pretty well.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Brian Bell. He is the founder of Design Corps. This is a nonprofit agency that provides architecture to people traditionally underserved by the profession. And they're pretty much, we're talking about most of America, well, certainly most of America has not used and will never use the services of an architect. But one of the reasons that a lot of people won't is that they just don't have that kind of money. He has edited a book which looks at this movement within architecture that's titled Good Deeds, Good Design, Community Service Through Architecture, and it is published by the Princeton Architectural Press. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just, you touched on something, and maybe you might want to amplify on a little bit, and that is what it is that someone trained in architecture can bring to a design problem like this. I think that it is the case that most people are living in some kind of a structure that somebody somewhere has designed, but it's the designs are fairly generic, at least when we're talking about single-family housing, and that maybe it can be altered in small ways by the contractors who build them, but sometimes it's the only people who are doing the kind of designing to accommodate people's needs are the contractors.
Right.
And that very, as we've said, just a tiny percentage of people could ever afford to go to an architect and start with a blank piece of paper and say, I want you to build something for me, and this is what I would like it to look like. I mean, what do people get, even in a situation like this, when they have the services of an architect that a builder couldn't do with existing kind of plans or just by making something up?
Right. Well, in every house design, there's thousands of design decisions being made. And what I mean by design decisions is basically, how are you spending the money you have to build that house? Now, in a lot of developer or contractor-built housing, you may be involved in a few of those decisions, but when a designer is involved and taking the approach that we're talking about here, the designer will, f- first try to understand what's most important to your family and help you allocate the resources to address those needs. Now, if the architect hasn't listened to you carefully, they'll fail because they won't know your priorities. So let me give you a couple of examples. And I work with, as you said, very low-income families. The houses cost about $85,000 to build. So you wouldn't think there was a lot of room for what we all think of as architecture. And a lot of times what we visualize by that is meaning that we blow the budget. Well, $85,000 is all there is. There's no option of spending more for these families. But there was one family, I'll give you an example, of a farm worker family. Now, the 8-year-old son was diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. Mm-hmm. And I went to visit the family in their housing. And it was a 3-room apartment that the farmer owned, and it was a family of 5 there. So I sat down in the, really there were 2 bedrooms and a everything else room. And Lorenzo was trying to do his homework at the table while the TV was on, while the mother was cooking, while I was talking. I mean, it drove me crazy, and I was just trying to talk, and he was trying to do homework. I realized I didn't believe he had attention deficit at all. It was the poor accommodation of that design. So when we designed a house for them, it was just 1,100 square feet, but what we did was we made it a 2-story house so that there was more privacy between the downstairs and upstairs. And where the stairs came up, we extended the outside wall by 3 feet, which gave a desk space for the 3 boys, including Lorenzo. So all of a sudden, this very critical aspect of education for one of the boys was accommodated with no extra money, just a reprioritization of how they were spending that money. In exchange, the living room was a little bit smaller, but it really was barely noticeable in order to get that study area. So that's the type of thing where something really important to a family can be accommodated. And I'm talking about day-to-day living, not something fancy, but this is something that can really help. And I guess that's the way I describe what I try and do. I try to really help. Hmm. But it really takes listening first and an understanding of who you're trying to serve. And I think that's, you know, architects are guilty of not really demonstrating services of value. And I think we need to redefine our own services and stop trying to build Taj Mahals to ourselves. That was the term I first heard when I left architecture school and somebody described what they thought of architects was that we build Taj Mahals to ourselves that bust the budget. So I think we need to do some pretty serious reevaluation of what we're trying to do and how we can help.
You talked about building a house for $85,000. Now, by real-world standards, now that we have a lot of people who are living in homes that cost $250,000 and up, and a lot of them up, you know, $500,000, $1 million, by those standards, $85,000 doesn't seem like a lot of money, and yet, to me, $85,000 is a lot of money. Is there some sort of bottom, some sort of floor here, past which you'd say you can't do something that will provide good quality housing for a family for less than that?
Well, that's a good question. I think $85,000 in the areas I've worked is sort of a floor, but let's kind of take design a little bit further than just housing. I do think, in some ways, home ownership opportunities is the best opportunity for design because it's one family and it's their particular environment, and you can be very specific about their needs. And with the increasing home ownership rates in this country, it has been an opportunity for people who have never been able to shape their own environment to become involved. And I guess I would summarize what I try and do is letting people be involved in the decisions that shape their lives. And that may seem like a pretty obvious thing that everybody wants to do, and And that's why I think design is important to everybody, because the environment, the routines you have every day, how well they may convenience you or inconvenience you, or accommodate such things as education and health. Those are the decisions that people should have a right, if they're buying a house, to be able to shape. But there are many more cases of design that don't involve $85,000. Sometimes one of my favorite projects involved a bench, a public bench in a small town, racially segregated town in Alabama. And this was done by a student, and it gave the African Americans there a validity of sitting downtown in a way that they had not had before. And that was a project that cost probably about $20, but it actually did more for that town socio-politically than probably anything had done in 30 years. So I don't want to equate design with cost. And I think design to me is about careful consideration of people. So it can be $20 or it can be $250,000.
Is there somebody who is doing this kind of work similar to the kind of things that you have been doing to try to provide some housing for migrant workers, doing this in an urban environment?
Well, that's a wonderful question, because there are people doing this all over, and it's migrant farm workers happens to be my own cause, but there are people working in pretty much every state and every city, and this is not really a new movement, but I think this generation is taking a good run at it and giving it some new energy. There is a city design center in Chicago run by Roberta Feldman that's doing wonderful work. There are city design centers in many cities. And there are also, I was pretty much in the trenches, and I didn't realize what was happening in the trenches, 10 feet away from me. And so one of the great things that's been happening is we've all started to talk and exchange ideas and realize that we all have more or less the same intent, which is expanding the benefits of design to a greater sector of the public. So one of the purposes of this book was to put all these ideas together so we could learn from each other and just start to establish a dialogue. And I hope they're pretty honest. There was a review recently that said they were disarmingly honest, which I thought was funny. But we do want to share not just where we've succeeded, but how we've made mistakes so that others can avoid those. But there are 30 essays by 30 different practitioners, and that's not to say by any stretch that that's all there are in the country. And one of the fun things about doing the book was finding more and more people that are doing the same thing. And also realizing, what a great number of the students that are coming out of school want to do this type of work. So hopefully we're defining a little bit of an alternative path for some of the 30,000 architecture students that are in school right now, and that they won't have to take 10 years, as I did, to try and figure out how to do this type of work.
Hmm. Well, also, and you've touched on this a little bit earlier, you seem to be making the argument, too, that that the profession, if the profession's going to survive, that it's got to try to broaden its mandate, that the architecture profession, if it's only going to serve 2% of the population, isn't well, and I suppose that doesn't take account of public buildings, but we're still talking about a small percentage of the population, that if the profession doesn't find some way to broaden its constituency, that it's not going to be able to survive.
That's right. Even with the public works, it's a very competitive field right now, and we need to find those new clients. We need to find the new jobs instead of just fighting for the few that are out there. Many architects will enter competitions and put hundreds of hours of work into a project that they may have one out of 400 chance of winning. And my suggestion to them is to try and find a local community group or a low-income family and dedicate that same time to working with them. And a real project may develop out of that, and probably a much better odds than 1 out of 400. So for some reason, we seem to be, as much as we talk about valuing originality in some of our professional models, we're very much like sheep, and we seem to all do the same thing. So trying to look at alternative methods of getting paid by low-income families and alternative methods of finding jobs. I pretty much now, any job I work on, I can tell you there's no other architect involved. If there's another architect involved or interested in the project, I'll just say, great, I'll go find another one. But there are many, many opportunities. I was recently at the Boston Architectural Center, which is an alternative school, and they had a lot of interest in doing this work, but there were students interested, the administration was interested, the faculty were interested. They said, but we don't know any projects out there. And I said, well, that's the easiest part. And you have everything you need already. I can probably find a project walking from within 1 mile of here. So, and in fact, when I was driving out of town, in a taxi cab, I looked over and there was a HUD building with a garden on the corner that was totally abandoned. And so I called him back and I said, well, you may have a project about 6 blocks away from your school. Looks like somebody had planned for a nice garden, but nobody had really executed anything there for the residents. So it was kind of fun to be proven that it was true, that these projects are pretty easy to find.
Let me introduce again our guest, and we have a couple of callers we will get right to. We're talking this morning with Brian Bell. He is director of Design Corps. It's a nonprofit architecture firm based in Raleigh, North Carolina, a firm that he founded in 1991. He's also taught community design build at 3 architecture schools. In 1995, he started the Design Corps Fellowship Program, which allows recent graduates to design for the underserved. And that's really the idea of Design Corps, that is to bring the services of architects and design in housing to people traditionally underserved by the profession. And if you're interested in reading some more on this subject, you could look at a book that he has edited. It's a collection of essays on this kind of movement and this approach within architecture. The book is titled Good Deeds, Good Design, Community Service Through Architecture, and it is published by the Princeton Architectural Press. 333-9455 is the local telephone number if you'd like to call in, if you have a question or comment. Also, we have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here. First one in Aurora on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, hi, good morning.
Yes.
Very interesting to hear about what you're doing, and I am listening very intently, but I wonder if you could explain. I go out of doors a lot, and I'm out in the country, and I see these huge, huge houses, and I know that only one or two people live in them, you know, just couples. In fact, I had a friend that lived in one of these houses, and they had to get somebody in to clean the windows with a 12-foot ladder and a huge brush to clean way up in the ceilings and the windows. And I suppose those people build those houses. Is it a want or a need there?
Well, I certainly wouldn't believe it's a need, and I think you're right. In a lot of ways, they're probably making it a lot harder to live in there. One of the ideas under discussion among architects is trying to present the difference between quality space and quantity of space. And I think that a lot of times there's a misreading of advertisements and houses as how big it is. And really, the experience of that space may be terribly uninspired and boring and inconvenient. And I think the definition of what design is and what it can do for people is very poor. We need to work on that. But I think you're very right that there is a tremendous difference between quality and quantity. And when I say quality, I don't mean expensive. I mean something that considers who's using it and addresses the solution carefully. So it's a really good point. I think they probably, you know, end up using probably 25% of the house, is my guess. And, of course, but they still have to heat and cool it. So, but I think it's just a misguided notion of what design is, and it's sort of that social status side of things rather than accommodating people, who they are, sort of expressing the character and qualities of people. And I'm not talking about just functional space here. I'm talking about space that also does have a respect for the spiritual side and the sort of value side of people. So but it doesn't have to be done with just huge rooms.
When I see these housing developments and they're all the same type of house, I'm sorry I sound negative, but I think they're all the people in the same ilk and prominence and dominance and of that kind of thing. The housing development, which I'm sure they don't call it that. What do they call it in a fancy neighborhood? They don't call it a housing development, do they?
Well, that's the technical term for it, yeah. But they may have they may have a name they like better, yes.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. And I think, well, everybody's the same way, and so they all gather in the same spot. Okay, I just think it's a waste of space for, well, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. Well, you know, I think that, Mr. Bell, that there are probably some number of people that would agree with the caller and would have concerns about that trend in design and build to single-family homes being very large structures, maybe more space than people really need, maybe a lot of wasted space, maybe buildings that don't pay a lot of attention to energy efficiency in either design or construction. But you maybe wonder that part of the reason that people are attracted to that is that's what they see, and that there aren't a lot of models of a different kind of building, something that might be a little bit more thoughtfully designed, that would be more energy efficient, that would use space better, but that also if people walked through it and got an idea of what it would be like to live there, they would compare that with one of these other kinds of styles of houses and say, in fact, that they liked the smaller space better,
right,
but that they don't often have the chance to make that kind of comparison.
That's right. And let me be clear, I'm not criticizing anybody. Everybody has a right to live in a house of their choice, or ideally everybody would have that. I'm not going to criticize people who choose a subdivision house or a large house. My point is that if there was careful consideration given, they might realize that the way they're spending their funding is really could be better spent in other ways. So I think you're exactly right. It comes down to understanding the choices you make and how well they'll accommodate you and what your goals are. So that's important. I think architects need to be careful not to transfer our own values, even with some values that we may feel are universal, such as conserving resources. It's a person's house, and I think that they have a right to express themselves. And I guess that's our job, is to help people understand what they want in a house and how to express that in three dimensions. So, and we're not saying that the wealthy shouldn't have architects, but unfortunately, it's only the wealthy at this point that seem to have the benefit of an architect's input.
Yeah. Well, we have some other people to talk with. Let us do that. And there, we have two callers here. They're both in Urbana. So first, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I agree with what you're saying, but it seems like your ideas are going against what is the common practice, which I dislike, of having builders who don't work with architects putting up what people call McMansions, and the financial community, which will give mortgages to these things. And you're right. In many cases, they're too big, poorly designed on the inside, energy inefficient for size alone and the way they're going to be used. With like the one other caller said, you know, two, three people living in 5,000 square feet of enclosure.
So,
how do you get yourself started to offer people? For young people who are getting what was called a starter home,
right,
to think about the effective use of space that they like. And I'll hang up and listen.
Oh, thanks for the call.
Well, let me go back to a statistic that David mentioned earlier, which is that architects only work with 2% of the new home buyers. And so the challenge for architects is, how do we increase that 2%. And the future of architecture is it will either decrease as we have these competition, as you point out, of the developers and the spec builders and the McMansions, and they're trying to decrease that 2%. And I guess my point here is we need to increase that 2% and bring the benefit of choice to people such as starter housers. Now, how do we do that? I think we need to look at alternative methods of service, and that's certainly what these essays are about, is how can we provide new methods of working with families. I have a program I call Direct to You Design, and it's five meetings with a new home buyer to talk about how they live and what their priorities are for their house. Now, in five meetings, you can get a lot accomplished, and it doesn't cost that much, but it really helps them realize some of the most important things to them in their new house. Now, if they're just looking at a few already built houses, they're never able to go through a process, and it's one of the things that I think architects have of value. We can take people through a process to identify what the needs are. And so there's so many examples of how this happens, and really where the architect is able to give shape to what's in the mind and heart of a family or a whole community. And I think when people realize that that's what architects can do, we'll start to have more customers, and we'll be able to expand who we help. So that's sort of the optimistic future, and that's sort of the cause we're all fighting for. But I think it's up to architects to prove what we can do. It's our fault, and it's our problem, and we have to demonstrate that we have a valuable service.
Let's talk with someone else. This is also an Urbana listener, line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I just tuned into your program, so I apologize if you've already addressed the issues I'm going to raise. But I had two issues I was hoping that your guest could discuss. The first is if he thinks that there's a relationship between consumption in terms of the amount of stuff that we have and think we need today and housing sizes. And the second issue is implications for changes in architecture and home building if oil prices continue to go up and stay high in the future. Seems that we'll need to be building denser communities so that people don't have to be driving as much. And I think density scares a lot of people because they haven't seen it necessarily done well, but it can be done well. I was hoping that your guest might be able to comment on those two things, and I will hang up and listen.
All right. Well, thank you.
Well, again, I need to be very careful about separating my own values from the values of anybody else who wants to build a house. And let me give you an example about a family. The very first family I ever worked with was in rural Mississippi. And I understand the value of pedestrians and not using fossil fuels for car transportation. But this was a family in rural Mississippi who had no inside running water or plumbing. And they could move to the nearest city and get HUD housing with plumbing and with all the modern amenities. But their tradition and their history was in a rural community, and they were afraid of what the city would do to their children, who were all honor students at the local public school. So the other thing about this family was really unique. It was a two-parent family, and it was the father hauled pulpwood, and he, it's sort of being the rural equivalent of somebody collecting aluminum cans. But it was such a strong family unit that the father's income was less than they would have received if he had left the family. So when I realized that and realized how little money they made, it was just so poetic to me, that the values of this family. So we designed a house for them where the father's truck, which actually didn't even have a hood on it, could be accommodated by, and this was the truck that he collected the pulpwood in, could be accommodated by the house. So there's a place for him to work and repair his truck. And when the truck was there, when the father was there, the sort of composition was complete. So it's a case where their values were rural. You know, they relied on their car for their living. So I think I agree with you personally. But at the same time, what I can't do as a designer is impose my values on other people. And I think when architects do that is when there's conflict and the house does not end up accommodating that individual. Mm-hmm. So it's a tough question. I'd love to say that, yes, we shouldn't let anybody use cars and the pedestrian is the way of the future, but that's really an urban priority. And there are cases where others have other values. So, again, it's very important for me not to transpose my own values onto people in their housing.
Well, I can appreciate that. I think the caller probably could appreciate that, too. Maybe let me ask you about the other question, though. There, if indeed we find ourselves in the future paying a lot more for energy,
yeah,
and it seems likely that we will,
right.
Then that's going to feed back to how we design and build buildings, because we're going to want them to be as energy efficient as possible.
Right.
And then, you know, there is, and maybe this is, again, more of a an urban sort of issue, that is the density question. And do, in fact, you think that people are scared of the idea of having people live too close together?
No, not at all. And I do think that, as you know, our costs and our, not just the cost of fuel, but the environmental costs of fuel go up, people's values will reflect that. There's no question. If it's a monthly check you write, that's a pretty immediate impact on your, but if it's also impacting such things as asthma and the air we breathe, I think that has a pretty immediate impact on people's values as well. But no, I think density is a personal choice, and I do think that there are tremendous conveniences and values to a high-density situation, but there are also alternative values to the rural lifestyle. And I don't, again, I think both need designers. I guess I don't think design is sort of more one than the other. I think design should have an ability to to cover all needs and all different varieties of lifestyles.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with our guest, Brian Bell. He is an architect. He is the founder of Design Corps. It's a nonprofit agency that provides architecture to people who traditionally have not been served by the profession of architecture, generally people on the lower end of the income scale. His firm is based in Raleigh, North Carolina, and he founded it in 1991. We have some other people here with questions, so we'll go next to a caller in Homer. And that's line number one. Hello.
Are you familiar with the I lived out in Longmont, Colorado, and they built a subdivision out there where there was garage apartments behind the houses?
Yes.
Are you familiar with that?
Yes. Yes, I think that's a wonderful approach to integrating an affordable, we call them grandmother flats sometimes, but it could be for a student. Yes, I think that's a wonderful way of mixing incomes within one community.
Well, where I was raised in a city down in, actually in Florida, in Jacksonville, we lived in a house that had a garage apartment behind it, and my dad bought the house particularly because he could rent out the garage apartment and help him with the payment on the house.
Yeah, that's a great solution.
We had a single person living in the apartment, and it was, of course, higher density, which is what we need. And we had a neighborhood grocery store, and, you know, we just stayed right in the neighborhood. My father worked in the neighborhood, and this concept in Longmont, which I think there's some other developments like that around the country I've heard about, and if to make it affordable for architects, I think, or for people to use an architect, this developer in Longmont, they developed the subdivision and restricted the builders to build a certain design, and it was spread over a lot of houses, so it was cost effective to have an architect in that sense. Do you think that would restrict urban sprawl, and if it was done on that kind of scale?
Well, I think there, you know, in a community, there are certainly some shared values, and that can be reflected in the same type of housing. But then there are always, you know, the differences between us, too. And I kind of like to celebrate what's unique about us. But, yeah, I come from New Orleans, where we have wonderful housing stock of double shotgun houses. And sometimes those are for two families. Sometimes they're converted to be for one family. And so there can be some common elements that can reduce costs through repetition. But then it's also, I think, ideal when the unique aspects and unique needs of everybody can be also accommodated. So, but I think, you know, your point about the additional income of the grandmother's flat, I think, is a really good point, and it's kind of the sort of broader thinking that architects need to take. We did a house for a young couple that wanted to run a daycare, and it was just at the time when the federal housing sources were saying that was allowed. For a long time, they wouldn't allow any additional income by the house. So we designed a house that it was two-story, so that the family had privacy upstairs. Downstairs, the open floor plan accommodated the daycare. So that actually allowed them to buy the house, which otherwise they couldn't have afforded. Now, that may seem a little strange and not really what people learn in architecture school to do, but that's the type of thing that I think makes my service of value to somebody and gives a sort of broader understanding of what their needs are. So, yes, I totally agree. There needs to be an understanding of how to save costs. And I think manufactured housing is really, we've had it for a long time, but I think it's really developing some interesting new variations. Roberta Feldman, who I mentioned earlier, did a invited exhibit called Out of the Box, where she invited designers to make proposals for well-designed manufactured housing. And I think that's going to be an exhibit in Chicago soon. So there are ways to save money, and architects should be very responsible and economical with people's funding. But, you know, the Internet is also an exciting new way. We just ordered a car, and we were able to design it to a limited degree on the Internet. And so you can have some customization ability in the near future, probably with house plans, by using Internet and some of the three-dimensional graphic tools. So I think we're headed in the right direction. And some people refer to this as a movement. I like to think of it as a progression, a sort of an obvious progression that is happening in other areas. Like you can custom design your own blue jeans and order them on the internet. So it's a way we're moving, and I think of it as an expansion. And it's, to me, it's exciting. And I think when people realize the impact of designing their own home and their own environment and their own community, that it's going to be an increasing and popular approach.
Okay. I can I ask one more question?
Yeah, if you can be quick.
The big houses you're talking about, should we allow, even though people have the money to build them, I mean, after energy costs, if they continue to increase, which looks likely, I mean, this affects all of us, and should they be able to have their ideals, and or should we restrict them from the development point of view, from the development idea, when the developer's getting going on something, should we restrict the development so they're energy efficient and not...
Right.
Not, yeah, and I can, Mr. Bell, I can give you about a minute to
okay.
respond.
Well, I do think that individuals are costing the community, that there are ways of approaching that, and there may be some sort of environmental impact fee is used, or there's a tax for energy consumption. But yes, this isn't Montana in 1870. This is we're all living together, and we have responsibilities. And I do think if people are doing things that are harmful, there are ways of accommodating and dissuading that disadvantage for the community in general.
Well, there we will leave it with the suggestion again. If there are people who would like to read more about this movement within architecture, you can look for the book that we've mentioned. It's titled Good Deeds, Good Design, Community Service Through Architecture, edited by our guest Brian Bell. The book is published by the Princeton Architectural Press. And if you're interested in finding out more information about Design Corps, company that the agency that Brian Bell founded, they do have a website, and if you have internet access, you can go to the website. It's www.designcorps.org, and you can learn more about them. And Mr. Bell, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much, David, for having me.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. And that's it for us here on Focus 580. We hope that you will stay tuned. Coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine. The program has the usual mix of news and weather and sports and features. And an interview from the archives of the Afternoon Magazine, the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, an archive interview with the media critic for The New Yorker, Ken Auletta. Let's take a look now at the Chicago Board of Trade. July wheat, 371, up 3 1/4. September,